Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the latest military gains by the Islamic State in Iraq, who have taken three towns from Kurdish Peshmerga fighters and are now threatening the Mosul Dam, the main supplier of water and electricity for Iraq. Nicholas Harris, an analyst with the Jamestown Foundation and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer, joins us to discuss the surprising success of IS attacks on the north that include the capture of another oil field and the brutal sectarian nature of the IS fanatics who are executing the minority Yazidi sect and blowing up Shiite shrines. Then, with 50 African heads of state meeting in Washington for the first Africa summit in the U.S., we will speak with Anidi Okure, the executive director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible relations with Africa. He joins us to discuss the three-day summit and its focus on business opportunities with a $1 billion package of business deals organized by the Obama administration, driven largely by the need to play catch-up to the Chinese, who have invested hundreds of billions in Africa, as well as discussing the need to build civil society, good governments, and fight corruption in Africa. Then finally, we'll speak with Dean Rice, a former congressional policy and legislative aide on energy and national defense, and Natalie Menieva, a research assistant at the University of Tennessee's Institute for Nuclear Security, about their article at CNN, "Is Ukraine About to Go Nuclear Again?" We'll examine the possibility that Ukraine, having given up its weapons to Russia, now needs them to protect itself from Russia. And we will also look into the role of Belarus, which has good relations with both Ukraine and Russia, but with Belarusians indoctrinated by Russian propaganda, while its pro-Russian dictator reconsiders his allegiance to Moscow after witnessing the trampling of Ukrainian sovereignty next door. We will examine that disconnect. And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, who's an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the James Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation, amongst other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me.
And before we get to the subject of ISIS or the Islamic State routing the Kurdish forces, taking over three towns and reaching the Mosul Dam, which supplies most of the water and electricity to Iraq, let's start with the other theater that you cover, and that is Syria and Lebanon. Just yesterday, 10 Lebanese soldiers were killed inside Lebanon by Islamist fighters from Syria. They apparently captured 18 others. We know that Lebanon is stressed because of the enormous influx of refugees from the fighting next door and is a tinderbox in itself. Is this kind of attack likely to spark a wider conflict?
I don't believe so in Lebanon. Arsal, which is in the northern Mekaa Valley, bordering Syria, has been an area of concern for Lebanese military since the beginning of the Syrian uprising. Arsal, which is predominantly Sunni Muslim, is surrounded by Lebanese Shia villages that tend to be politically dominated by Hezbollah. Arsal was linked until very recently to a series of towns and villages in a mountain range called the Kalemun, which straddles the Lebanese, which is located between the Lebanese and Syrian border, and is particularly strategic because it is within close proximity of Syria's capital, Damascus. Arsal was linked to towns like Yabrud and Ankus, which were, until recently were controlled by the Syrian armed opposition and were used as hubs of moving weapons into Syria, areas of lines of resupply and communication for the Syrian armed opposition, and also are believed to have been centers of manufacture for car bombs, some of which were used in the southern suburbs of Beirut against areas that Hezbollah controls. The attack against Lebanese military over the weekend, in my analysis, is a result of a widespread perception amongst the armed opposition that the Lebanese military is not a neutral player in the Syrian conflict. At the officer corps, there's a great degree of coordination between the Lebanese and Syrian militaries because of tradition and also because of almost 20 years of Syrian occupation of a large portion of Lebanon, and also because of circumstances on the ground. The Lebanese military, according to my sources who are in the Lebanese military and who were forward deployed in the Bekaa Valley in a special forces role, the reality is that there's a high level of coordination between the Lebanese military on the intelligence gathering level and Hezbollah, because Hezbollah has extensive resources on the ground and is able to react swiftly against armed opposition groups crossing the border between Syria and Lebanon, and also Salafist jihadist groups such as Jabhat al-Nusra, which is stronger in Lebanon at this point in time and potentially the Islamic State.
Well, let's turn then, Nicholas, to ISIS's activities in northern Iraq and the fact that apparently they don't know that they've taken this dam. There are conflicting reports over this extremely important dam that provides most of the Iraq's electricity and water. However, apparently they did catch the Kurdish Peshmerga forces by surprise in the middle of the night and took three towns. And at this point, apparently there are, you know, hideous massacres going on because of the nature of ISIS and their extremism in terms of considering every other Islamic religion a heresy. Apparently they are driving the local inhabitants into the hills, and these belong to a religious sect, the Yazidis. So at this point, give us your understanding of, one, why the Peshmerga, who are considered to be pretty good fighters, why they got routed, and two, do you know who's in control of this key, important Mosul dam?
There are conflicting reports over who controls the Mosul Dam. It seems that at this stage, the Mosul Dam is still contested, that ISIS controls most of the routes towards the Mosul Dam, but the dam itself is yet to fall completely under the control of ISIS. That having been said, the three towns that were seized, Sinjar, Zumar, and Wana, are, as you pointed out, predominantly inhabited by sectarian minorities, most of whom are Yazidi, who follow a faith that predates Islam and which has elements of Manichaeism in it, and also Shabak Shia. And the Shabak are a splinter sect of Shiism that are considered to rever the Imam Ali very highly. Both of these groups are considered apostates by ISIS, and thus, in their worldview, perfectly legitimate targets for execution, which is the Peshmerga forces in those three villages are at the end of the KRG's lines of supply and communication with them. Sinjar in particular has been one of those areas of contestation, territorial contestation, between the central Iraqi government, the armed predominantly Sunni opposition in Anbar and Nineveh and Saladin, and the Kurds. The Peshmerga forces, in my analysis, based on what I'm hearing from sources on the ground, were overextended. And because Sinjar is on the edge of what's traditionally considered core KRG territory, those forces made a tactical withdrawal because they were in danger of being overrun. What will be interesting to see moving forward is to what degree the Kurdistan Regional Government accepts the Iraqi military's offer to provide air support. Now, as we know, the Kurds have sought United States air support in conjunction with Peshmerga attacks and also requested advanced weaponry from the United States. The United States thus far seems to prefer to follow a policy of supporting the central Iraqi state and asking the Kurds to coordinate with Baghdad. And Kurds have to play this very close to their vest, because on the one hand, They can't risk their forces being overextended and potentially losing other border areas that ISIS controls in Nineveh and Saladin governorate. To accept the Iraqi military's offer of air support, that is a recognition of the fact that the Kurds are unable to confront ISIS themselves, which, as you pointed out earlier in this conversation, the reported tenacity of Peshmerga forces and the Kurds' claims that they would be themselves able to confront ISIS without the support of the al-Maliki government would appear to be weaker. And that's an argument that the Kurds, at this stage in the game, where they're seeking to solidify their control over the contested city of Kirkuk and to solidify their claim to independence, cannot afford.
Again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the James Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation, amongst other publications. Now, obviously, the Kurds want to, they're asking for America's help and for better equipment, because apparently the ISIS or IS forces are, because they've grabbed so much sophisticated equipment from the U.S. supplied equipment from the Iraqi army when it fled. Supposedly the Peshmerga have been outgunned. Now, I take it the reason that Maliki is offering air support is because he simply cannot abide the idea that the Kurds could turn to America for help. So, given the relationship, the somewhat dysfunctional relationship between the Kurds and Iraq, and the extent to which the Kurds have gone it alone and prospered, about the only stable part in this entire region, what's your analysis, Nicholas, on the long run? Will the U.S. at some point or other, I imagine if they start helping the Kurds, that would be the end of their already pretty shaky relations with Maliki?
Nouri al-Maliki also needs to demonstrate to the United States and other concerned international actors, as well as to opponents of his within the Shiite political camp, that he can be a strong leader and that he can take decisive action and that he can reach out to the Kurds and work with them against threats to the region and to the world beyond. I do not see a scenario at this point where the Kurds are going to easily accept Nouri al-Maliki's or Baghdad's support, for that matter, without some sort of understanding that support, any support that would be provided to the Kurds, does not constitute the Kurds' acceptance of Baghdad's control over them or the Kurds withdrawing their desire to seek their independence and to control Kirkuk. Any scenario where the Iraqi military provide military support and in coordination with the Peshmerga against ISIS would be tactical, would be used to push back ISIS, but it has to come with an understanding from Baghdad that the diplomatic and political process that the Kurds are seeking to have with the Iraqi central government, which is the eventual independence of the Kurdistan regional government from Iraq, and the establishment of a Kurdish state will not be halted by any military support that's provided to the Kurds by Baghdad.
But my understanding is that Baghdad itself is being threatened by ISIS or IS, that they're quite close, and I'm not entirely convinced that Maliki's army is worth anything. I know he's got the Shiite militias, but they, of course, seem to be more interested in terrorizing the what's left of the Sunnis in Baghdad. So what's your sense of, obviously, Kurdistan and the Peshmerga are going to be around a lot longer than Maliki, don't you think?
Nouri al-Maliki's position as Prime Minister of Iraq is extremely tenuous at this point. The United States seems to have made no questions of its desire for Maliki to leave the office and for a Shia politician to assume the prime ministership that will be able to reach out across the aisle to all of Iraq's sectarian and ethnic groups, as well as political differences. The issue that ISIS faces at this stage, at this point in time, is that where it has been the most successful in Iraq have been in predominantly Sunni Muslim communities, acting as a sort of shock troop for an already existing predominantly Sunni armed opposition. And Baghdad itself, I have doubts that Baghdad itself would fall. If ISIS was able to seize Baghdad, it would be one of the greatest, and this isn't with hyperbole either, one of the greatest military achievements in the modern Middle East history. As you pointed out, there's a large number of predominantly Iranian mobilized Shia Iraqi militias that have moved to Baghdad. You have the remnants of the Iraqi military that are in Baghdad. You also have significant outside support, at least in terms of foreign internal defense. The United States is present there with military advisors. The Iranians famously present there with the head of their Quds force, Qasem Soleimani, reportedly making several trips to Iraq from Iran every week. That having been said, the position militarily on the ground in Iraq is at a very dangerous point in time, because while none of these parties are able to outright defeat the other, they are able to solidify their control over areas where their communities, whether they're predominantly Shia or predominantly Sunni or predominantly Kurdish, happen to be concentrated in the largest numbers. And moving forward, in terms of the political process, there has to be some sort of understanding among all of Iraq's communities that there needs to be a center, and that if Iraq is going to maintain its territorial integrity and to maintain some form of responsive governance, and it is to move forward with humanitarian development and economic development, that there has to be compromises made. And at this point in time, there doesn't seem to be an appetite for compromise. There's an appetite for rhetoric. There's an appetite for conflict, but there isn't an appetite for compromise.
Well, given that you mentioned earlier, Nicholas Harris, that the Peshmerga, who are overrunning these three villages and are now defending the dam, the important Mosul Dam, which is under attack by ISIS, that essentially this may not be a significant event in this much as the Peshmerga have been routed, and that therefore they're not the great fighting force that they've we've all been led to believe that they are. And you said that they were at the end of their supply line, so maybe this is not an example of the Peshmerga being vulnerable so much as an example of them literally being overstretched, but in terms of defending Iraqi territory as opposed to their own. But in this incursion by ISIS into the north, apparently they've also taken another oil field, and that's probably part of their motive. I mean, obviously taking the dam, the biggest generator of electricity and supply of water in Iraq, that's a huge strategic objective in itself. But I also understand that they've also grabbed yet another oil field, and that seems to be a part of their objectives. They control oil fields now in Iraq and in Syria, and they're already involved with black marketeers in selling their oil to be a self-sustaining, self-financing entity, along with all these extraordinary cache of weapons and cash that they took from the banks and the weapons they took from the Iraqi army. So, you know, one of the things I find extraordinary, Nicholas, is we all thought that al-Qaeda was pretty radical and they were a handful, but this new crowd seems to have pushed the envelope into a whole new arena.
They have, and what is startling about ISIS's advance is just how blatant it's been in targeting civilian communities that it considers to be apostates. And there had been bombed ISI, the Islamic State in Iraq, the precursor to ISIS, had, of course, bombed Shiite communities, had bombed Yazidi communities that attacked the Shabab. But the blatant nature and almost, in a sense, systematic targeting of civilian communities that belong to sectarian groups that ISIS considers to be apostates is appalling. And on the other hand, what is frightening about ISIS, or something that should be an area of concern about ISIS, that's also learned from its experience in its prior incarnation as ISI, and that it's been trying to make significant outreach to Arab tribal groups that exist in areas of Syria that it controls and also in Iraq that it controls. And one of the most interesting sub-dynamics of this oil conflict they've mentioned is that a branch of the large Shamar Confederation, which is found in Iraq, in Syria, in Saudi Arabia, the Shaitat, which are located in Syria's eastern Deir ez-Zor Governorate and Hasakya Governorate, which border the areas of Iraq that ISIS conducted its operations in this weekend. That sub-tribe has fought, pushed back against ISIS after having declared allegiance to ISIS over conflict over local oil wells. And this is something that ISIS is going to have to contend with. As ISIS tries to build a state-like structure in the territory of Syria and Iraq, it's going to have to maintain the cohesion not only of its fighting force and the foreign fighters within its fighting force, but also local Arab tribes that try to build its state upon. The success of ISIS in the long run is going to be determined by its ability to either co-opt or convince the Arab tribes in Iraq and Syria, that it is deserving of being the supreme authority in the areas that it controls.
Well, just in closing, my understanding is that ISIS have already been kidnapping Ba'athist generals who originally had an alliance of convenience with them. So if I was a Sunni tribal leader, I'd be very suspicious of ISIS or IS in the long run. They seem to be absolutists. They're not people given to making deals or let alone compromises.
I agree with that analysis. They see ISIS, in its own rhetoric, sees a historic moment, and it is deadly focused on seizing that moment. And that moment is the destruction of the Sykes-Picot boundaries that have been set after World War I.
Well, Nicholas Harris, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. It was a great conversation.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation, amongst other publications. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anidi Akuru, who is the Executive Director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He's a member of the Order of Preachers of the Dominican Province of St. Joseph the Worker and has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the United States. And he is the co-author with Dean Hoge of International Priests in America, Challenges and Opportunities, and African and Caribbean Catholics in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anidi Okure.
Thank you.
And African Summit is underway with President Barack Obama convening African Civil Society Summit with 50 African heads of states. It's underway in Washington, D.C. And I imagine, given that the leaders of Sierra Leone and Liberia canceled their summit trip to Washington because of the Ebola outbreak. It seems to be very much in the news here in the United States. Is that very much on the agenda in these discussions, even though that wasn't what was originally planned?
No, it isn't. Actually, that is not much on the agenda, even though we see a lot of that in media coverage, but it's not on the agenda. The agenda is going on as planned, and as a matter of fact, I just came in from an event, you know, that was focusing on the resilience of Africa and food security, which featured the AU chairperson, Madam Zuma, and we had the president of Senegal, the prime minister of Ethiopia, and other dignitaries from the continent. So the event is going on as planned, and since the Ebola case was not part of it, I don't see it featuring in any of the events that have been planned so far.
So the fact that Zimbabwe, Sudan, Eritrea, and the Central African Republic are the only countries that weren't invited, and you mentioned the president of Ethiopia. Ethiopia, of course, has had some reversals in human rights under the current regime. There have been a lot of journalists arrested. And how much would, for example, the president of Ethiopia be in the spotlight in terms of African civil society, in terms of turning back the clock, which is apparently what he's doing?
Yeah, you have touched on something that has been very sensitive for many of us, That means many of us who are advocates for justice for Africa in Washington, is that this gathering has put civil societies on the margins, unfortunately. But having said that, let me go back a step backwards, namely that the gathering itself, the summit itself, is of historical importance. You know, there is nothing like it before. And so for that reason, it is an opportunity to put Africa on the limelight in the United States, which, as you know, the media generally doesn't talk about Africa. But this summit has the chance to do that. But it's also, what we have noticed, focusing too much on trade. And in a way, we think that it's basically the U.S. playing a catch-up in trade relations with Africa, a continent that it has not focused on for a very long time. And now that we have many European countries and China playing big roles in trade relations in Africa, it really is time for the U.S. to start looking at the possibilities that are there in Africa. For example, China itself has a trade investment of $220 billion in Africa. The U.S., only $58 billion. So when you look at that, that in itself makes the U.S. feel it is in a deficit in terms of relations with Africa. And the fact that we know that Africa is, quote, the next emerging economy. It is right now the place where investment has the highest returns. So when people look at that and the trade, U.S. Department of Commerce, which is the biggest sponsor of this gathering, makes us understand that that is commerce, trade, that is at the upper hand. So because of that, we haven't seen a role, a central role for civil societies. In fact, we had to challenge the process some 6-7 months ago to say, where is the role of civil society here? And although things have been organized that include civil society, it's not at the center. And we know that Africa's problem today is a problem of governance. That is central. Is the lack of accountability of their government, is the marginalization of the citizens who don't participate in the governing process. It is the lack of rule of law. And we have governments who go in there, and the next thing we know, they change the constitution, you know, in terms of presidential term limits. And they are there forever. You know, right now as we speak, which is something that has been of great concern for the Africa Faith and Justice Network, right now we have five African presidents, you know, who have between them been in power for 163 years. Only five of them. We are talking about the Equatorial Guinea president, Obiang Nguema, 35 years in power. We are talking about the president of Angola, you know, Dos Santos, 35 years in power. We are talking about Zimbabwean president, Mugabe, 33 years in power. You have the Cameroonian president, Paul Biya, 32 years in power. And you have Museveni of Uganda, 28 years in power. Between the five of them, 163 years. Can you imagine? And many, all of them, each one of them had changed the constitution that talks about presidential term limit. They've changed it. And they've done so on the back of civil society, suppressing them, suppressing opponents, and sometimes outright eliminating them, you know, by death or some other means. So that is really the central problem of Africa, which we do not see as having a role or a place in this gathering, as great as it is, which we applaud the gathering. It's a wonderful thing. We know there has been U.S.-European summit, U.S.-France, Africa-Europe summit, but this is the first of its kind between Africa and the United States. And the one thing that the U.S. is known for, namely promoting democracy and civil participation, is lacking, and it's making us a little worried about the direction it's going.
Again, I'm speaking with Anidi Akuru, who is the Executive Director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He's a member of the Order of Preachers in the Dominican province of St. Joseph the Worker and has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of Congo. But Anidi, when you say that China has invested hundreds of billions of dollars and that this summit taking place in Washington now of 50 African leaders invited by President Obama, and the fact that the Commerce Department is playing a big role, and there is, of course, the U.S.-Africa Business Forum on Tuesday where the president is going to give an address. But in terms of this summit, the U.S. is apparently going to unveil about $1 billion in business deals and more funds for peacekeeping and for food and power programs during this three-day summit. But when you compare the hundreds of billions that the Chinese are investing in Africa and the $1 billion that this summit is going to announce, the comparison is pretty stark.
It certainly is. It certainly is. In fact, the U.S. is playing catch-up. That's the way I see it. You know, unfortunately, it's playing catch-up. Granted that, I mean, China is investing in trade and is not quite interested in colonizing Africa. But you know what? When the person who has the money, the person who has the financial means, is in a bigger advantage, you don't need to be a colonial power to control the game. Especially in this day of money and money, where money decides many things. So, yes, that is there. And I think the United States suddenly wakes up and said, hey, wait a minute, we could have done something a while ago. And so that's why I say they are playing catch up. It's true. I know there is also the incentive of trying to, quote, improve agriculture. But we also want to make sure that they don't do that at the back of poor farmers. Right now, 70% of food consumed in Africa is produced by small farmers, most of them women. And so what is at danger now is that we have these large corporations from Europe, from the United States, from Russia, from South Korea, some from Saudi Arabia, who are going into Africa, some from India, but who are going to Africa and grabbing huge, huge portions of arable land in the name of mechanized agriculture. And what that has done is that they have ended up displacing the local farmers, displacing their source of livelihood, marginalizing them, and in fact, in some places, outright relocation. They have been put away from where they lived, what they knew as ancestral land, been taken over by companies who pay little or nothing to the government. Let me give you an example. A farmland in the Midwest, you know, a hectare of farmland, which is about, 1 hectare is about 2.47 acres, costs about $28,000, right? The same farmland in Africa is being gotten by many of these corporations for 50 cents. Sometimes, some who pay more will be like $7, 10 cents. And they're signing leases for 39 to 99 years to own it. But the food, what they are producing, is not to feed Africa, it's to feed the West. Most of it is used to produce, say, jatropha or palm oil for clean energy. So they've ended up taking arable land that produces food to plant food that the Africans themselves are not consuming. So that's something that needs to be carefully examined. If you want to help the people to produce food, then give assistance to the local farmers and not bring in this huge agribusiness to take over land and produce whatever they want at the price they want and however they want it. You end up with aggravating the situation for the local people.
And, of course, this is taking place on a big scale in Ethiopia and in South Sudan and across Africa. And
Cameroon, Liberia, it's across the continent.
Sure. But I'm interested, though, in what you're interested in, being the head of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, Anidi Okuru, and that is the extent to which good governance, civil society is on the agenda here in spite of the focus on commercial activities and the U.S. trying to play catch-up to China. Shortly after President Obama was elected, in 2009, he gave a speech in Ghana.
In Accra, Ghana, someone saying, you know, Africa does not need strong men.
Right, and he talked about good governance, the rule of law, and civic participation. So is he revisiting those themes, do you think? Not that he's spoken yet, but he's organized this summit. So we've been watching what's happening, the tragic events in Nigeria, where the Boko Haram kidnapped all of those young women. And there's nothing more embarrassing than the behavior of the government of Goodluck Jonathan. They've been blaming the victims, you know, accusing them.
Blaming the victims and blaming those who were trying to do something to help. You know, it's really an embarrassing situation, and even more embarrassing for Nigeria, given the role Nigeria has played in peacekeeping on the continent. You name everywhere, you know, even the West African peacekeeping force. Nigeria pays about 70% of that. We've been in Liberia, we've been in Angola, we've been in various places that have been conflict, in Mali, in Chad, in everywhere. And yet, that same military that is known to be excellent in peacekeeping can't control Boko Haram. You know,
and that leads you to be suspicious of all kinds of agendas that aren't very clear, right? I mean,
absolutely, it makes people see. You know, people have drawn all kinds of conclusions, and they're rightly so, because what is expected of one, the central government that allowed Boko Haram to become this terror organization, it could have been handled 7 years ago. Boko Haram started in 2002, and we knew from the beginning that it was a trouble organization. It could have been stopped, because that is not the first. We had Metai Sine group that came and was, stopped. We've had several groups like that, but they allowed this one for political reasons, and because some elements sympathetic to Boko Haram had exploited it at the beginning, even though it has turned deadlier than they thought it would be. But then there was that. For me, the fundamental thing is that Boko Haram has succeeded in being what it is because of poor governance, because of the lack of the rule of law, because of corruption among the political leaders, and because of people, elected officials, who are there primarily for themselves rather than for the people. If they were for the people, if there was rule of law, if the governance and people who are elected to office were interested in providing the common good for the people, Boko Haram would not have been what it is today.
Well, Anidi Okuru, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Anidi Okuru, who is the Executive Director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He is a member of the Order of Preachers in the Dominican province of St. Joseph the Worker and has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And he's the co-author with Dean Hoge of International Priests in America, Challenges and Opportunities, and African and Caribbean Catholics in the United States.
Hey, rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dean Rice and Natalie Benieva. Dean Rice is a former congressional policy and legislative aide on energy and national defense and a recipient of the 2013 Peace Award by the Society of Universal Dialogues Atlantic Institute. And Natalie Benieva is a research assistant at the University of Tennessee's Institute for Nuclear Security. That together they have a recent article at CNN, Is Ukraine About to Go Nuclear Again? Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Rice and Natalie Menieva.
Thank you very much.
And let me begin with you, Dean. The idea that Ukraine could or is about to go nuclear, of course, takes one back to the 1994 Budapest Agreement when, in order to extract the nuclear weapons from the former Soviet Union, out of Ukraine, an agreement was signed between Britain, the United Kingdom, Ukraine, and Russia. And of course, that in exchange for getting the nuclear weapons out, the agreement was supposed to honor Ukraine's territorial integrity, which of course has been violated by Vladimir Putin's grabbing Crimea. So, I guess that's the place to begin, right?
I believe it is, and it begins with just national self-interest. If you look at what has happened in Ukraine, and from the Ukrainian perspective, they're in a position to take the words of Vladimir Putin, President Putin, in a letter that he wrote to the U.S. on September 11th of last year. He said that if you have the bomb, no one will touch you. And he said it's just if you're in a situation where you're international law no longer matters, and he was using that as a persuasion for us in Syria. But his words have come back on him. He said, "If you can't rely on international law, you have to rely on yourself, and that means get the bomb, and no one will touch you." Ukraine has listened to him, and as July 24th, we had the president call for the prime minister to resign in Ukraine. He stepped aside to set in motion future parliamentary elections. 2 days before that, a bill was introduced to step away from the non-proliferation treaty and to go to renuclearize. So it's a gradual progression from the time that we wrote the article. It's playing out on the ground in a very logical Ukrainian self-interest perspective, but it's all driven by the actions of President Putin and of Russia.
And Natalie Menieva, since you come from Belarus, I'm interested in also talking to you about the relationship between Ukraine and Belarus, which has apparently been a fairly enduring one. And in terms of Lukashenko, the longtime dictator there, I take it you also work on polling in Belarus as well. I'm curious to know, how is Lukashenko maintaining a traditional relationship with Ukraine at the same time having this pro-Russian relationship with Putin, given what Putin has done to Ukraine and continues to do in terms of destabilizing the east of Ukraine?
Well, yes, thank you, Ian. I'm working closely with ISEP. It's a polling organization that does public opinion polls in Belarus, so I have the fresh data that I want to share with you. And you're absolutely right. President Lukashenko, who has been in power in Belarus for the past 20 years, actually this year he had a 20-year anniversary of being in power, he has always been very smart in trying to play the West card and the East card at the same time. He had a very good relationship with Russia, and he got subsidies, gas and oil prices from Russia, and this is how he was able to maintain the Russian economy, by getting all the subsidies from Russia. But at the same time, he had pretty good relationships with other countries, including Ukraine. At the same time, recent events between Ukraine and Russia, it's interesting to look at public opinion polls and to see how people in Belarus have reacted to that. And I can tell you that the reaction of the Belarusian public is the opposite from what the West expects it to be. In the recent public opinion polls that results have just published recently, people in Belarus were asked the question, how do you evaluate the annexation of Crimea by Russia? And 62% of people think it was restoration of historical justice and there was nothing wrong with the annexation. Moreover, when people were asked about what do they think about those people in eastern Ukraine, the separatists, Belarusians said that it's people, normal people protesting against a non-legitimate power in Kiev. So you can see that the public in Belarus, and I can tell you from my experience with other countries in the former Soviet Union, people in those countries perceive the Ukrainian events through the lens of Russian media. So they support Russian actions and they view the Kiev authority as non-legitimate, and they don't see, unfortunately, Russia as being a threat.
So let me turn to back to Dean Rice, again, a former congressional policy and legislative aide on energy and national defense and a recipient of the 2013 Peace Award by the Society of Universal Dialogues Atlantic Institute. The when you talk, and of course your CNN article makes the case that Ukraine is about to go nuclear again, but there's a big distance between an aspiration and actually getting a weaponized nuclear weapon, not to mention...
Thankfully, that is correct, yes.
And not to mention a deliverable nuclear weapon. Yes. So where would you put them? I mean, there are countries like Japan, for example, that could go nuclear fairly fast. They've got a lot of fissile material. What kind of... And of course, we're watching Iran very closely in that regard. What kind of timeline would you give from Ukraine to go nuclear in terms of a deliverable weapon?
Sure, certainly. So, and that's an excellent question. It's one that, you know, I would hate to put a specific timeline on from a technical standpoint. But in terms of the debate, the decision to go nuclear has clearly not been made. But the fact that they've introduced legislation during a time of over the next few months, there will be parliamentary elections for all 450 seats. And if you look at the latest polling data coming out of Ukraine, by the Kiev Institute, that the three major nationalist-leaning parties, which have not only introduced this legislation, but are also leading in terms of a number of the polls of the coalition, the Svoboda Party at 7%, and the Udar Party at 12%, and the Fatherland Party at 18%, gives them a 37% block that's going to certainly have influence. What will be interesting to see and very telling is during the time of the actual campaigning, which is usually 60 to 45 days, likely leading up to October elections, is the debate on this issue on the campaign trail? Will we hear this become a platform or even a litmus test for candidates running, rallying the nationalistic leanings that are certainly being enhanced every day because of Russia's actions? If we see that, then I think we would see coming into a new government a move to actually follow through and do this. If not, hope it would just become rhetoric and it would be not an issue, except for other countries that hear the rhetoric and say, hey, we should talk about it also. There's also that spiral effect that we have to keep an eye on.
So, Natalie, how do you see this developing? Is this a case of creating your own nemesis?
Unfortunately, that might be the case because, you know, the events have been unfolding worse and worse for Ukrainians. According to the official numbers from the Ukrainian internal ministry, there have been more than 1,100 people from the military, from the Ukrainian side, that died since the start of the conflict. And that's not civilians. We're just talking about the soldiers. 1,100 people, that's a lot. And that means that the public in Ukraine wants more and more direct and aggressive response to Russia's actions. And there are not too many options that the Ukrainian government can go, and certainly going nuclear is one of those options. So I think that's one of the possible developments. And I also want to pay your attention to the public opinion polls that are coming from Russia, because, you know, there's so much discussion from the media right now about Vladimir Putin having a strategy of trying to reestablish the Soviet Union and, you know, reestablish the old sphere of influence of Russia. Well, unfortunately, I need to tell you that based on the numbers from Levada Center, which is the most credible poster in Russia, Putin's policies in Ukraine and in general his foreign policy is completely and absolutely supported by Russians. Today, in July 2014, which was the last poll, his approval rating has reached 85%. It's more than he ever had, 85%. And 64% of Russians blame the West for steering the conflict in Ukraine, so they don't even see Russian fault in what's going on in Ukraine. And I think the most astonishing number that came from Russia recently is that only 3% of people in Russia consider it to be Russian fault that the Malaysian airplane went down.
How many percent in Russia think that it was Russia's fault that the Malaysian airline was shut down? How many?
Only 3%. Yes.
Well, this is what's so surreal about it. I don't know whether either you or Dean have read the article by David Remnick in the current issue of The New Yorker, but it's basically a profile on the former U.S. ambassador, Michael McFaul. And it's very clear that Putin is in an alternative universe, that because he comes out of the KGB, he thinks that somehow the United States is run by the CIA, and that they run the world, and that they're very good at it, when in reality, I don't know that they could organize a dogfight in a pound, and that they don't have much influence in the United States in terms of governance. But that's nevertheless his mindset. He believes that Ukraine has been taken over by fascists, and he believes that NATO is moving to take over all of the former Soviet Union and right up on their borders, when, as far as I can tell, NATO is a paper tiger. There are no U.S. tanks in Germany. The Polish foreign minister was recently caught on a secret tape recording saying that being a member of NATO is absolutely worthless. And there was a NATO war game done recently to determine how long it would take Russia to recapture the Baltics, and it would take them about 5 days. So let me put that to Dean first and then Natalie second. How do you deal with a world leader who has absolute power and has 83% approval ratings, and yet he believes stuff deeply that is just so unconnected to reality?
I agree. And even more frightening than that is, and Natalie can speak to the numbers, is the fact that he's not an isolated leader dragging his people that direction. He is reflecting the sentiment of a nation, and the notion of empire is deeply seated there. And it was asleep during the past 15 years, but it's waking up when they smell weakness. And I can assure you that Mr. Putin has done similar exercise strategic tabletops looking at the Baltics as well. But a lack of resolve on the part of the West, when we unilaterally say we have no more options, we've done all we can do, you cannot expect anything but further aggression against you. There are bad apples. There are bad characters, actors on the world stage, and they have to be addressed.
Well, but just in closing to both of you, now, starting with you, Natalie, you mentioned the factor of hatred, and hatred tends to be somewhat permanent, or at least it lasts a long time. And there's never been any real hatred, as far as I know, between the Ukrainian people and the Russian people. But there is now. And the fact that, as you mentioned earlier, 1,100 Ukrainian soldiers have died so far in fighting to essentially liberate their own country. So isn't this is where it's heading, that these people on the Russian side who are being whipped up by propaganda, their hatred is artificial in effect, but on the Ukrainian side, the hatred is real, is it not?
I think at this point, the hatred is becoming real on both sides, Because, of course, if you think about the events from the standpoint of Ukrainians, their people are dying. You know, their national sovereignty and their electing government and their rights are being taken away by Russians, so it's legitimate. When you talk about why is this hatred being, why is this hate growing among Russians, I think there are two answers to that. And first of all, Russians as a public are not very happy with the idea of the former Soviet Union republics being independent. They never were happy with this idea after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and they were looking down on the nations of the former Soviet Union, including Belarus and Ukraine and other countries. So there was always a question in their mind of how legitimate those countries are. That's number one. And number two, you know that mass media in Russia, especially television, is completely controlled by the government. It's used as a propaganda machine. And in the past 3 months, if you would read Russian mass media, it's warmongering and it's brewing hatred. There are stories in mainstream TV stations in Russia about, I think it happened 2 weeks ago, about Ukrainian forces in one of the little towns in Ukraine crucifying a three-year-old boy in front of his mother because the mother was speaking Russian. And this story was run on the main network in Russia, so all the 100 million Russians saw that story, and they trust state-run media, so they trust that those atrocities are being committed by Ukrainians. And of course, that story had nothing to do with reality. But when you're constantly being fed information like that, you change your opinion about the neighboring country and you see it as an enemy.
And Dean Rice, a last word from you on that, on this same subject. Is the hatred that's being generated permanent, or certainly it's going to be difficult to undo?
Absolutely difficult. You're looking generational. And it's, you look at how long it took from the Balkans for that to begin to have some sense of normalcy. And what's being done now, it's senseless and it's needless. You go back to the Sochi Olympics. That seemed like an eternity ago in terms of geopolitical landscape in that region. But it wasn't that long ago, really less than a year, and we've spun to this point. And it's frightening. And but it's also at the same time not to be alarmist. I mean, I think there's a difference between being an alarmist and being a realist and saying there are bad actors, and we have to, our foreign policy has to reflect confidence that is going to stand with what the values that our country has always stood for, and we don't see that confidence. We see your hesitation right now that does not help the situation on the ground at all.
Well, Dean Rice, I thank you for joining us, and Natalie Maneyeva.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dean Rice, who's a former congressional policy and legislative aide on energy and national defense and a recipient of the 2013 Peace Award by the Society of Universal Dialogues Atlantic Institute, and Natalie Maneyeva, who is a research assistant at the University of Tennessee's Institute for Nuclear Security. They both have a recent article at CNN, Is Ukraine About to Go Nuclear Again? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.